And welcome to this week's episode of Until Green Card Do Us Part, a weekly show where we address the issues that immigration-based marriages made a few feet short of heaven create for American citizens and their families. I'm your host, John Sampson, CEO of CSI Consulting. Now, last week, I had said that we were going to get into actual cases. Well, here we go. I'll be interviewing an actual victim of immigration marriage fraud today. Her name is Emily. She lives in Oregon, and her story is powerful, but I'll leave it to her to tell it. Well, I said in my introduction that we would be talking to an actual victim of immigration marriage fraud. Allow me to introduce Emily to the audience. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome to be here. We really appreciate it. Emily's located in Oregon, and she married an individual from Africa, and it didn't go the way she had hoped. So what I'm going to do, Emily, at this point is tell me a little bit about yourself to begin with, and then get into how you met and when you went to Africa, and we'll take it from there.
Sure. So I'm 46 years old. I'm a finance professional. I think it's important to add, because I have had people ask me why I wasn't smarter, that I graduated first in my class from American University. I have an MBA from Berkeley. I have a CFA, which is a Chartered Financial Analyst designation, a CAIA, which is a Chartered Alternative Investment Analyst designation. I speak a bunch of languages, including having the Paris Chamber of Commerce Business French proficiency and the Barcelona Chamber of Commerce Business Spanish proficiency. I currently work as a chief financial officer for a global nonprofit. And how I came to meet my now thankfully ex-husband was, at the time I was running a small international all-women's adventure travel company, and I had the occasion to travel to Tanzania once a year. And I would guide and use a local ground handler to run safari and trekking trips there for my all-women's group. And it was on one of those trips that I met my ex-husband, who at the time I actually thought was quite handsome and attractive. He was quite a bit younger than me, though. And so I decided to absolutely put that out of my mind, because the last thing I wanted was a complicated international romance, which is ultimately later what I got.
Yeah, I would imagine it would be complicated. If you don't mind me asking, what's the age difference? How old were you? How much younger was he?
14 years.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a bit, but I found it's kind of funny. Once I turned 40, I found that only guys in their late 20s and early 30s were interested in me. So I had a little bit of an ego about that. I was like, yeah, I'm still hot in my 40s. You know, of course, why would I doubt this? Why would I question this? Now I feel like an idiot, but at the time I was like, oh, sweet.
Okay. So pick it up where we just left off. So you're running this tour organization, put it simply, and you met this individual on one of your safaris or excursions into, as you said, Tanzania. So was he one of your tour guides or safari guides or what?
Yeah, he was an assistant guide, yes. And then it's common practice to basically Facebook friend everybody on your trip and the people you worked with. And he in particular kept pinging me over the next year and asking me how I was doing and if I was coming back. I actually decided to shut down the travel company because it was losing money. I had a commitment to myself. I would never sell a house or commit a house as collateral for any business. And I got to that point, so I decided to shut it down. And at one point I said, well, sorry, I'm never coming back because I shut down this business. And at that point I didn't hear from him again until actually an interesting caveat is why I went to go. And then I moved to Tanzania and began to work there. The company that I used to use, we call them a ground handler, was also run by an American woman and a Tanzanian man. And he had been beaten the living daylights out of her. And after 17 years of running the business together, she fled the country. So she came to visit me in Oregon and was in quite a state. he knew that I was basically unemployed and looking for my next gig, and was like, wow, you would be a great general manager to go back and help me safely run my company from here. And so I was like, fine, I'll go for 2 months, make sure I can handle working with this ex who was violent, but at the time I didn't know a lot about domestic violence. And I rationalized that he'd only been violent to her, and if I was helping them with a business, then it would make both of their pockets grow, you know. He'd be all right with me. So I went for 2 months, and I just posted something on Facebook saying, hey, all of my Tanzanian friends, it's easier than writing them one at a time, here's my number and just text me so I'll have it in the phone, let's get together. So, of course, my ex texted me immediately, and then called, I think, almost every day until it's like, let's get together. And I just didn't want to put myself there because I knew I found him attractive. So I kept putting it off until he came and got me so we could go on a date.
Okay.
And then things moved pretty quickly from there. As you know, he's very charming, courted me, moved very fast, said basically everything.
So how?
I wished an American male had said.
So how soon after? Or I'm assuming all this happened when you got back to Tanzania.
Yeah.
Okay. How soon after you got back from Tanzania did he start what I would refer to as the full court press?
Oh, probably a week, maybe even two.
Okay.
Almost instantly. Yeah.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about him. We don't want to disclose his name for obvious legal reasons, but, I mean, was he previously married? Did he have children? And then the other question I've got for you is, did you meet his family? And if you did, how did they react to you and how did they treat you?
Okay. Well, he's very tall, very striking, very handsome, really stands out against the backdrop of Tanzanian men. Big smile, big personality, laughs a lot, fabulous English, had been working with Western tourists for a long time, so he really knew how to interact. I knew that he'd had a previous, I call it mke, which kind of means wife, but sometimes that means you're actually married or you're not. So he had a previous mke, that's the Swahili word, and had 2 children with her, but she was not in the picture. He said, which was interesting, that she left him for a new man. When we ended up splitting up, that's exactly what he told everyone else, that I left him for a new man, which, of course, was false. I think probably about a week before he went full court press, and then it was like another week before I met the family. And whole family, they live in Obama, which is a compound. Everybody has their own house. It's a little bit far apart, but like the family basically owns the land. And he's got a huge family. His parents were very accepting of me. They're actually Pentecostal ministers, and I'm Buddhist, and they knew that.
Okay.
But they were, like, really lovely people, and I would go to their service, and it was just so, like, genuine and beautiful and heartfelt, and I would sing in Swahili, and I, like, enjoyed it as somebody that doesn't really like a lot of organized religion. So they totally accepted me. He has 3 sisters, a brother. They have kids. He literally has so many cousins. He doesn't remember all their names because his grandparents were polygamous. Polygamy is no longer accepted in the younger generations, but that makes for a massive family tree. But they were super welcoming. Just totally, like, every night his mother brought me raw milk from the cow, and we'd boil it, and I'd drink it before bed. I mean, it's just sweet.
Okay. So.
And his kids.
I'm sorry?
Okay. So his kids. His kids, too. Okay. This was part of the hook. All right. So I'm now 42 at the time. Everybody said my clock would start ticking when I was 30. It didn't. It started at 40.
Okay.
So 42, going like, what have I done with my life? Focusing on my career. I want love. I've been looking for that, right? But now I feel like I want kids. And his kids, I joke and say they were cuter than crack cocaine. Not knowing what crack cocaine is actually like, just for the record. But they were adorable, and he got them to call me Mommy Emily pretty quickly.
Okay.
And I totally fell in love with them, too.
All right. So All right, so we have the full court press. How long were you in Tanzania before you came stateside back to the States?
2 months, and then I came back for a month to complete an EMT course that I was already registered for, emergency management technician. And when during those 2 months, he had encouraged me. He was like, I know we can make it. This is meant to be. You're the love of my life, blah, blah, blah. And so I did. I secured a contract with the trekking and safari company there so that they would get my residency permit and I would work full-time as their general manager.
And in Tanzania?
In Tanzania.
Okay. Yep. So you went back. So I'm assuming you came back for your EMT course and then you went back to Tanzania. When did the subject of marriage come up, and how did it come up, and who brought it up?
I remember it being really, really early on. I mean, one of the things we talked about, I wanted to get an apartment in town. So he lived an hour and a half away from the second company.
Okay.
And I, of course, I assumed I'd get my own place and we'd keep dating, right? And then I wouldn't have this horrendous commute and all that. And he's like, no, you have to live with me. You're my umke now, like my wife. And, you know, why should you pay rent? And you'd be part of the family here, and the kids love you, and yada, yada, yada. I'm like, well, that's great. Like, how many guys do you know that are commitment phobes about moving in? I was like, whoa, this is awesome. It also meant I had an hour and a half commute each way, which was very taxing. But I can't remember exactly when, but it was very soon. I mean, it was within the first month or so. Because then he did... he proposed to me for the first time, I think, at the end of April. So I'd been there less than 5 months, and he actually proposed to me and gave me a ring.
Okay. So he proposed. You accepted, obviously. So
yes.
How did you proceed immigration-wise? Because there's two ways you could have proceeded. You could have gotten married in Tanzania and then filed the I-130 alien relative petition and then have him go for an immigrant visa in Tanzania.
Yes.
Or is that what you did?
Well, you know, I wanted to give this one little other caveat or part of the story, which is that I found out he cheated on me right after he proposed. And the situation with this other Tanzanian man that had been violent had started to feel unsafe for me. So I left Tanzania.
Okay.
And I broke it off with him.
Okay.
So for the next 3 months, I got calls and texts incessantly all day long.
Okay.
And I had a split trip planned to go back that September because I had friends that were coming to trek with me. And I didn't want to leave them on the hook trekking in Tanzania without me. So I went back and he professed, I mean, he had been professing his undying love and how he'd screwed up and I was the woman of dreams and da-da-da-da. And then he proposed again. And that's the proposal we actually cite in the immigration document.
Okay.
Then I was like, you know, we can't live in Tanzania. You know, I know I'm unhappy in Tanzania. We did talk about how to proceed. And that I think, you know, I really felt like getting a Tanzanian wedding. Well, I already knew. This is kind of funny. I already knew from that other couple that was like in this horrible, horrible, you know, violent divorce that you can't even get a trial in that province for 3 years. It's like the California 6 month cooling off period, but there it's 3 years.
Okay.
So like, I don't know about that, man. And I wasn't sure if the U.S. government would trust any Tanzanian documentation, which now I also know you shouldn't because I've seen some of the things that got done. And so we decided to get married in the U.S. and do the fiancé visa. I also did like a little bit of the like, oh, so you have the 90 days to make sure it's all good once you get here. He'd never been to the U.S.
Right.
So I would say it was a joint decision to go down that path. I never felt like he strong-armed me to do this, but that our life together going forward was going to be in America.
Okay. So let's fast forward a little bit. You come back to the United States and you fill out the I-129F fiancé petition. It gets approved by USCIS, obviously, because he came here.
Yep.
And so he and the children, the two of them, wind up coming to you in Oregon. Were you in Oregon at the time, or were you in California?
I was in Oregon. I had a commuting arrangement with my job then, so I'd come back and forth. So they came into California. We had the wedding in California.
Okay.
Very public wedding on the grounds of the founder's home of my organization. So talk about super shame later when it didn't work out. And then we flew up to Oregon and settled into the house here.
Okay. How many people showed up at the wedding? I'm just curious.
Probably about 40 or 50.
All right, so this was not one of those that we're going to show up at City Hall or County Clerk's office and get married, and there's only going to be a couple of people there, and off we go. This was a organized, celebratory, marital ceremony where you had friends and family present, I'm assuming.
Yes. And my friend officiated it. In fact, we got notices of visa. I already had a trip planned to Thanksgiving. I had to scrap those tickets, reorganize everything. Basically, this wedding got planned in 3 weeks, thanks to all my friends who contributed money, who made cakes, who figured out children's games, who officiated. Again, these founders, that was at their home. They cooked for us. They didn't have budget for a caterer. Like, the whole community came out to support this union and embrace my ex and his children.
Well, that sounds a lot different than the typical situation that, you know, you get married within 48 to 72 hours after getting here on a K-1 visa. So this was something that...
Well, we still did that. I just had it planned that fast.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right. So long story short, he winds up... You get the K-1 visa, he comes in, you get married, and then you file the H-64 affidavit of support, and he files the I-485 to adjust his status and that of his two kids. And I'm assuming did you go to an adjustment of status interview or not?
Yes, we did.
Okay. In Portland. How did USCIS comport themselves at that interview? I mean, were they suspicious? Were they friendly? Were they, you know, perfunctory in that, you know, okay, you're married, here you go, have a nice day?
I would say much more perfunctory, and especially because the children were kind of all over me the mother that they adored.
Okay.
I just had this feeling that this woman, like, saw that and was like, okay, it's done.
Okay.
I also disclosed, and this was one of our biggest arguments where there was almost violence, I disclosed that he'd done unauthorized work. And I actually saved him from being deported by doing that. And he didn't want me to do it.
Okay.
Our attorneys told us, if you, as long as you disclose it, you're fine. But if you don't, then you've committed fraud. Uh-huh. So we had our first big argument. I mean, we argued about a bunch of stuff, but where I thought he was actually going to hit me because I said I couldn't commit fraud. That plays into some things that happened later where I continued to refuse to commit fraud.
Okay. So how long? All right. So I would assume that at the interview, the adjudicator, the immigration service officer, approved all the paperwork. And then shortly thereafter, the 2-year conditional permanent resident alien registration card showed up. What happens next?
Well, I have to say, you know, from that point, it was like late April when we actually got the green cards themselves and the notice of the adjustment of status. But once we filed for the paperwork, which all went in, we got married on December 1st, which was 4 days after arriving, and filed on December 31st, I think it was, because there was a snafu with the marriage certificate in San Francisco.
Okay.
But between then and even March, when we had our interview, it started to feel like a low form of torture. There were just arguments every day. One of my friends joked when I said, he said, you know, I seem very controlling. And they're like, compared to what he saw back home, you probably were. And but I'm like trying to convince him not to leave the kids alone. I'm like, that's against the law. They're 4 and 7. You can't leave the house and go, they're going to be fine. You know,
well, you can't drunk drive here. You know, and mostly, like, I'm like, you're going to kill somebody, and they're going to sue me for it. Like, just complete disregard for the laws or anything.
So I take it he had a drinking problem? I mean, you said he was driving and drinking.
Yeah, so there were so many things that changed once he got here. What I had witnessed in Tanzania was that he rarely drank, but when he did, he could be a mean drunk. But I didn't think he had a drinking problem. So once he got here, he started drinking regularly. Okay. And he got meaner, and we would have debates about how much alcohol was actually too much. And I'd show him an ABC chart, and he'd be like, nah, 10 is, that's just calculation. 10 is fine for me. So it was a little weird because I never pegged him as an alcoholic, and then he started behaving as one once he got here.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing once he got here was he seemed to have absolutely no interest in me, and I'd actually asked him discuss the topic of divorce twice, where I'm like, are you sure? Like, yeah, like, you seemed in love with me before. You don't seem interested in me at all. Like, wasn't interested in my religion, wasn't interested in rock climbing with me, and that's my big passion. I think anyone that actually knows me nothing else. So that changed. Then it was just the, like, air of tension and constant fighting and, you know, these, like, threats of being physical but not being physical. And I probably give people too much grace and have enough appreciation for the culture shock the times I've lived abroad. And just the stress and new marriage and all that, like, it's going to work its way out. So the thing that then, you know, there's these key timelines. Then there's, like, March 9th, the interview, then getting the green card. It was April 9th, getting the green card at the end of April. And then it was about 5 weeks later that that actually hit me. And unfortunately, it happened in the middle of the night where no one could see us. But, you know, that's the way these things go down, or in the middle of the night where no one can see us. So I have no proof, and thus it makes it really difficult for me to prove that, right?
Right.
He punched me in the face, and it turned into a full-blown kind of like wrestling, punching, trying to get away. I had no bruises or scratches. He was very dark skin, none visible on him. My theory now, knowing what I know, is that he hit me. I did hit him right back.
Okay.
I'm so angry that he was trying to provoke me. And then, you know, because nothing happened afterwards, neither of us had injuries that were visible. You know, I didn't go to the police department. But neither did he, but what could he have said or shown, right?
Right.
It took me almost 2 months to finally go to the police department and file a report. I was just so shell-shocked. I'd never experienced anything like that. I was almost like, did it happen? It's surreal. I was, like, filled with shame, and if I say anything, the whole door is going to be, you know, blown wide open.
Right.
About what an idiot I was bringing this guy over. And I also had this vacation to Morocco for 3 weeks. And I was like, I'm holding that to, like, it's like a lifeline. I got to get there. I got to do this for myself, you know? And I got so much clarity on that trip. So I came back and filed the police report.
And what did the police do?
So the police, they asked me what I wanted. They're like, do you want to go and get him arrested? We can go arrest him right now. Or do you just want this for documentation? And I said, documentation, because as weird as it sounds, like, I don't want to hurt him.
Okay.
But I want this on record, especially in case he does it again.
Right.
The weird thing that went down, like, and, you know, this whole thing gets more and more surreal, is that he shows up at the police department at the same exact time I'm there to file a police report against me. Now, why did he wait 2 months?
Well, I got a better question.
Wait, why did he show up when I was there?
Well, and the question I'm about to ask is relative to that, and that is, did he know you were going to file a police report? And if so, how did he find out?
I had told him because I actually went into hiding for 3 weeks after I came back from Morocco. I told him I wanted a divorce. His reaction was scary. I continued to talk with him on the phone, and he wasn't accepting it. I met with him twice in person. Each time he restrained me physically. So I kept saying, if you don't accept this divorce, I'm going to have to take, I don't remember how I said it, police action or legal action. And so he knew that I was planning to do something. Right.
Okay.
But I don't know how he knew I was going to do that and was there at the same exact time. And I had been careful and tried to turn off all my location services.
Okay.
So whether or not he saw I was there or what, but yeah, I the officer said, now what would your husband say? I'm like, I don't know. He'd probably say he doesn't remember it or that he's the best husband ever. And they're like, because he's here. And I swear to God, my jaw didn't just drop to the floor. It dropped beyond.
Okay. went into the sub basement. So.
Yeah.
All right. So let's. Excuse me. So let's get into this. So you ultimately filed for divorce, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you didn't have him arrested. Did he have you arrested when he showed up at the police department?
No, I think they thought his claim was baseless because they actually put it all in the same police report.
Okay.
Which also then he didn't have his own police report to then go and file a vow waiver. And it just said he came in, and it doesn't actually look like he said anything against me in terms of what they write, you know, and what he actually wrote down was that he never laid a hand on me. He thought I was cheating on him. I don't know, you know, stuff like that.
We're going to get into
he didn't actually say she assaulted me.
Right. We're going to get into this.
So there?
We're going to get into the he thought you were cheating on him in just a moment. Because you and I both know, okay. Because you are a client of mine, so I'm familiar with the facts.
Yes.
You ultimately filed for divorce, and then you convert that over to an annulment petition.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
And now you also took out a restraining order against him, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and he violated that restraining order, and that resulted in him getting
twice.
And yep. He got arrested at least once.
Yes.
Okay. What did the district attorney do with that arrest? Or the judge?
So, you know, first I want to say that I filed for the restraining order because I was truly scared. I couldn't go back to my house. Again, he'd restrain me physically, but also because I just didn't know anything about this whole environment. And my therapist was concerned for me. She's like, you know, when the highest probability of a woman getting killed is once she's just left. And I could see his behavior changing and I was really scared. So I got the restraining order. With less than a week, he came to the house, dropped the kids off. They were crying. I let them in. He drove around the corner, came back and asked them to open the house from the inside because I'd changed the locks. It was after I'd gotten back into the house, obviously. He was arrested. I had a friend visiting from California. She was a witness. So there were four of us as witnesses. The whole thing was recorded on dispatch once I called 911. The police interviewed us all, and they said, it's mandatory arrest. We have to arrest him. And I still felt guilty. Like, I never wanted this to escalate this
right.
far. But they're like, you know, we have to do this. So a few weeks later with that first arrest, the DA's office actually made a clerical error and dropped all the charges by accident.
And I was devastated. How convenient.
Yeah, okay. I know, but I remember I was actually like yelling at this woman going, mark my word, I'm going to get killed because he's just escalating, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, I'm so sorry. We're going to do all these things for you. We're going to get him, you know, in anger management, and do another no contact order, and he's going to have to take a victim impact class and blah, blah. There was a whole bunch of things. But even though she screwed up, she was going to work with the defense attorney because they knew this was all just a mistake. Well, and have the initial assault investigated. None of that ended up happening, except for the 7 months later they investigated the initial assault. And, I mean, I'm not surprised. No one was around. There's no proof. They decided not to press charges.
Right.
But that's part of the whole thing. No action. So then before the plea was, I guess you call it inked in front of a judge, he violated it again by calling me. And, you know, it's one of those technicalities where I don't know that they would have gone after him as a violation for that alone. But they had promised me if he violated again, they'd go after him for the full force of the whatever 6 months in jail that he could be subject to.
Right.
So this woman that actually made the mistake seemed very excited. She's like, oh, yes, you know, call that in, make it a report. Now, because he's violated it again, before this deal is done, we can open it back up for the first case. I was like, oh, thank God, right? Well, before anything goes forward, then he contests the restraining order. We have a restraining order hearing. That assistant DA also said she would come and represent me to make sure no way in hell did this restraining order get dropped. The night before, she told me she was called away for training and she wouldn't be there, and I didn't have time to find another attorney. So I tell the judge this, I'm pro se. He shows up with a bulldog of a lawyer, and that lawyer basically like tears me to shreds with full-on victim blaming. But mm-hmm. I'm prepared, right? I'm an MBA. I have my screenshots. I have my statement. You know, I read it. My saving grace, the domestic violence shelter advocate that came with me, said it was the best she'd ever heard because I'm an overachiever, even with my victim statement. And the judge, and that assistant DA gave me a letter saying, you know, under no circumstances should this restraining order be dismissed.
Okay.
And they wouldn't accept that into evidence because it's hearsay. And I was like, well, I didn't know that. She should have known that. Right?
Well,
so I'm like, I feel like I'm being fed to the lion.
Well, here's the thing on it.
Here's the thing on that.
There are exceptions to the hearsay evidence rule. And official government documents, which one could argue that was, or a business record, is an exception to the hearsay evidence rule.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I didn't know that either.
And yeah. As a result, I mean, you're talking about a letter from an assistant district attorney, presumably on the letterhead of the actual district attorney, and she's writing this in her official capacity as an ADA. Yes. Now, I'm going to inject a phrase in here. And that phrase is sanctuary jurisdiction. Do you think?
That I'm not familiar with.
Okay. A sanctuary jurisdiction.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you think it's possible that that judge harbored a sanctuary philosophy that he didn't want to make a ruling that could potentially result in an adverse immigration consequence for this individual and his kids?
So his attorney's main defense, he gave the I-864 as evidence in the restraining order hearing. And I was like, what is that about? Like, yeah, I know he signed that, but what does that have to do with anything? And that's when the argument started, or that they put it out there that I was making all of this up to avoid my financial obligations. I don't know whether that judge, I mean, it blows my mind that I'm educated, articulate, I mean, obviously credible, you know, and that the judge's main thing was he said, I don't find you credible because you have too much detail, which seemed ludicrous to me. And I still don't find the harm in, like, if I'm scared of someone and they have a history, I don't know. I couldn't convince him that I had any reason to fear in the future, so he dropped it. So I don't know, but the fact that that was brought up as my motivation was avoiding the I-864 in that hearing.
Well, that's a very real possibility. And the way they did this from where I'm sitting and listening to this is that what his attorney was saying is she's trying to get out from under the I-864 affidavit of support. And what the unspoken part of it was by getting him deported. And then that's where it from, again, I don't know this judge from Adam. You and I have discussed this previously along with your attorney. And it got to a point where I believe that this judge, unfortunately, was politically or philosophically biased, with a bias to be lenient on this individual so that they wouldn't get deported. So ultimately, this restraining, all the restraining orders get dismissed. Charges are thrown out. No one's going to do anything.
Well, that happened later.
Right.
That happened later, and that's where I think you're more right about the DA's office. I don't know about this one particular judge, but the DA's office, and when they dropped both those charges that came back on, I think that his defense attorney got to them with this whole, because they mentioned when they called me to say they're dropping them, all of the charges, they mentioned because they felt I was financially motivated. They actually said that to me. And I don't know in my entire life if I've actually screamed at anyone. I've shouted.
Okay.
I've stood up. I've put, you know, hands stopping people. I've never screamed. And I screamed like bloody murder because I couldn't believe it.
Okay.
I was living in, you know, whatever you call it, upside down world. Where
Alice,
how could you call me?
Alice in Wonderland, looking glass world. So
I be financially motivated? He's suing me for all this money. And I didn't even know then. I didn't know until the November after the August, September, October, where all this restraining order stuff was going on. In November, he sued me for support and most of my assets and said he wanted my car and he didn't want to help pay off any of the debt from bringing him over, which he promised to do. And then it was in January the DA's office dropped all the charges and cited my financial motivation. I mean, it just a slap in the face.
It is.
An actual victim who's fighting for her life to say she's financially motivated when he's suing her.
Right.
Blew my mind.
So let's get to, you filed for the, initially for a divorce, change it into an annulment petition. And meanwhile, I'm assuming you've contacted USCIS and said, hey, wait a minute, boys and girls, you need to know about this. You need to hear about this because I got a problem.
Yeah, I contacted them multiple times, but there's not really a great avenue. I mean, there's like the marriage fraud hotline where you literally like, it's a short form on the internet.
Right.
And then it, you don't even know where it goes. Two other people reported marriage fraud because of things he'd said to them.
Mm-hmm.
I reported it. I also, after consulting with you, found out that the fact that he wouldn't disclose his address to me, I had no idea where he was. And I was uncomfortable that that is his sponsor. I should at least know where he was.
Right.
And so I let the attorney general know and the deputy, the high chair of the USCIS know, because the immigrant has the opportunity or requirement to update their address within 10 days of moving, right? I don't think ever done that.
Well, on top of that,
and then once you know,
on top of that, you're required to let them know if the marital relationship results in a separation because you're on the hook for the 864 affidavit. So there's a requirement in the 864 that requires you to let them know. So you fulfilled all your requirements, your notification requirements. You let them know what's going on. So,
yes, and once I changed for annulment, I definitely sent in a copy of the annulment filing.
Okay.
And again, still guessing where to send this stuff, right?
Right.
This service office looks good. How about that one? I'll send it to both.
Right. So you don't hear anything from USCIS. He has conditional permanent residence. The marriage is on the rocks. And tell me about the annulment hearing.
So I'll also add, I changed it to annulment a year in. It took almost 2 years to get divorced. When I first consulted my attorney about it, I was like, I just want to get divorced as quickly as possible. I don't want to be legally married to him. I don't this. I consulted with an immigration attorney trying to make sure he wouldn't automatically get deported. And, you know, ironically, I didn't want him to get deported at that stage. We didn't feel like we had enough. I mean, he told me verbally when I said I was filing for divorce, and I think his plan failed of getting a police report against me. He asked me to come home, and we could live under the same roof, just in separate rooms. And I could even bring my new man. He always referred to the new man. And that if we can just stay married and until he could get the green card. Later, like in my haze of like this whole surreal world, I missed the fact he'd sent me a text along those lines too, which I did bring to the annulment hearing. But that's all I had at that time. And my attorney said, annulments are so hard to prove he intended to defraud you. Well, over that next year, both just having the time, the clarity of thought, the new posts he kept putting up on social media, not very wisely, I was able, talking to people, they're like, oh, yeah, he told that to me. And so we're able to amass a case for annulment. Mm-hmm. The annulment hearing took 2 full days.
Right.
I think we had a really good, I think we had a really strong case. I don't know if you want me to go into the case at all, but given that that particular judge didn't have a predictable way of ruling, let's call it.
Right.
And because my ex was asking me for $93,000 in cash, which is completely insane, after a 7-month marriage.
Right.
And he wanted the I-864 support as alimony. He just wanted that $2,800 a month, regardless of if he was working or not. And so I had a lot on the line to let this one judge determine, like, even if he gave him half of what my ex was asking him for, it would have been devastating. So they proposed a settlement to me immediately after leaving the courtroom. I think they felt like they might lose. And I think his lawyer thought he wouldn't get paid his attorney fees. He's motivated to negotiate the settlement.
So
what else do you want to know about the hearing?
All right. Well, who all testified to begin with?
Oh.
And then this hearing took place on the 23rd and 24th of February, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep. Well, first I want to say who testified on his side was a teacher from the school who said that they had seen us a few times together at the school and we seemed happy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the other, it was a married couple that testified, and they literally passed the phone to each other and said the same exact thing. Probably had dinner with them 3 or 4 times. They were a couple that had been a missionary in Tanzania. So they spoke some Swahili, and we got together a few times, but after we split up, they really supported my ex. So they really interesting testimony, because I think they're very honest people, and while they're quote-unquote on his side, they said that they saw how broken he was after we split up. And my attorney very astutely asked, what kind of emotion did he display? Did he display anger? And they're like, yeah, anger, yeah, lots of anger. <They're> like, sadness? Yeah, a little sadness here and there. Anything else? No, mostly anger. And it's like, you know, really? And then so it's like he wasn't broken up about losing the love of his life. He's angry he wasn't getting his way. And they also asked, how was Emily as a mom to the kids? And they were like, well, you know, it's clear she was a new mom, but she was trying really hard and the kids seemed to love her and they called her Mommy Emily. And so you hear this story of, you know, him saying he loves me until today. His friends saying he was only angry after we broke up. And then, you know, and then me saying like, oh, no, it was not really very good from the beginning once we got here. And then you go, what's credible? Right. That he still loves me even till today. And he's so totally heartbroken. You know, I don't know. I was like, really? That's all you got? Your witnesses? Like, oh, my God. So I had, you know, quite a swath of people. Of course, I had you. Testify of your expert knowledge of immigration law and the way it's particularly with marriage, how it's abused.
Mm-hmm.
I had one of my longtime friends of 15 years who'd been there from the very beginning when I went to AFCO, when I met him, when I was heartbroken he cheated on me, when I went back, all through the immigration process. She was the officiant at the wedding. You know, she was supportive as we were breaking up. And she testified to all of that. He also said he called people crazy stuff. Like I got married to some new man in Morocco and she's like, I was there with her in Morocco. There are lots of men around. She didn't marry any of them. Right? One of the most interesting was my friend Lucas, who, is an ER trauma nurse. And he had seen, so after I was, he assaulted me, it was like a week later, actually miscarried. And I was in the hospital in the middle of the night. I didn't know what was happening, but I was having contractions and not cramps. And super painful, went on for many hours. And Lucas, who works for, is a helicopter service, was on shift and literally like flew in and checked on me. And he said he regrets it now because he's DV informed, domestic violence informed. But he was there as a friend and not as a medical provider.
Right.
But he said tons of red flags went up for him. Like, my ex wasn't looking at me. He wasn't looking at Lucas. He was looking at his phone. A doctor came to talk to me at that time, and I, you know, gave permission to Lucas for Lucas to stay. And he wasn't looking at the doctor. He wasn't asking any questions, you know. And he's like, "And you were a mess, Emily."
Right.
And he's like, "I've known Emily for a decade. We've climbed crazy mountains. We've gone on search and rescue missions. We've like had patients lifted into Blackhawks." And he's like, "I've never seen her scared before," and she was scared.
Okay.
So that was powerful.
Okay. So ultimately, and before I go any further with what happens next, you were pregnant as a result of your marriage to this individual from
yes.
Tanzania. Okay.
Yes.
And did he exhibit any remorse or any grief over the loss of your child?
You know what's weird? He seemed kind of ambivalent or maybe even relieved. And I think that's really weird in retrospect, because I know that one of the way that domestic violence abusers keep their victims entangled is with children.
Mm-hmm.
And like, even as I'm saying that out loud now, I'm like, wait, no, maybe that does make sense, because he didn't want to keep me entangled. Right. He wanted to get rid of me so he could sue me. Like, that's what I had spent a lot of time working through, those mental machinations of like, wait, if we just stayed together, I would have continued to probably pay for everything and complain, like, you got to pay for more. Right.
Right.
But I wanted a family.
Okay.
You know, but until I told him my one deal breaker, I could handle almost everything else. We reconciled after cheating. I could like handle anything except for violence. Like,
right.
If you ever hit me, I leave you. He punched me in the face. It took a couple months, but I left him.
Right.
And why? Because we can't get a divorce. He can't sue me for AI-64 support. He can't get any of my assets unless we're split up.
Right.
So how do you get me to leave you? You hit me.
Correct. And you and he provokes, and here's the other thing. And oftentimes this does happen in sham marriages. Before he got on a plane in Tanzania and came to the United States, thanks to Congress passing the International Marriage Broker Regulatory Act in 2005, he was told and given written information, pamphlets.
Oh, yeah.
From the State Department and USCIS, with resource material, primarily the National Domestic Violence Hotline and other information about his rights and protections under the Violence Against Women Act, under the immigration law, before he even got off the plane in California.
Yep.
So
yep.
He already knew what the playbook was. And
yeah.
So let's get, what they do is they try to provoke the U.S. citizen into hitting them so that they can immediately call the police and say, "I'm the victim," or file a restraining order, claiming, "I'm the victim of domestic violence. I can get out of the marital relationship without having to stay in the marriage for the 2+ years the law requires." And to add the insult to the injury, which is what this guy is doing to you, is I can sue her on the 864 affidavit of support as well. So,
yeah.
You get to pay for the...
I cannot escape my abuser. I have to pay my abuser. Yeah.
Yeah. You get to pay for the privilege of being abused and for the privilege of being defrauded. So...
I've thought a lot about that document, John. Thought a lot about that document because they get it ahead of time.
Right.
They attest that they've read it. Right. I never got any such document about my rights. as a U.S. citizen.
Well, that's because you're not...
I never got anything about my rights under VAWA. Right? And VAWA is being used against me as a woman who's actually been abused.
Right.
Like, it is totally perverse.
It is. And you and I...
Yeah,
you and I are going to get into that in another episode. And get into what you and I have already discussed about potential remedies of both VAWA and the 864 affidavit of support.
I got lots of ideas, as you know.
Yeah, well, you know, you and I have had this discussion, and we're sitting there thinking, gee, you know, let's see how far we can run with this. So what I want to do is I want to wrap up with, because we've been at this for just about 50 minutes, believe it or not. And I know that when we did the pre-show interview, we were saying, well, let's keep it at about a half an hour. But obviously, you know, it is what it is. So we've had the hearing. I testify. Everybody else testifies. And then his attorney comes back to you with an offer to settle.
Yes.
And you agree to that offer to settle and and revert back to it being a divorce rather than an annulment.
Correct.
Okay. And what are the provisions?
Why on earth would I do that?
No. Well, there's going to trial. Well, this is what I tell every one of my clients. Going to trial is a crapshoot. If you can negotiate a settlement that's acceptable to you and minimizes your risk, then if not totally eliminating it, then you would be well served to negotiate it, because you don't know what you're going to get at the end of the rainbow. So apparently that's what happened. And what are your liabilities now under the settlement agreement that you have?
So I paid his attorney fees because his attorney knew he wouldn't get them otherwise. I have no other obligations. My assets are safe. The debt's mine to keep, too. But the really telling thing is that, one, he had me put in writing that I will not do anything to proactively harm his ability to get a green card now, which I've since learned is unenforceable, which is great. But that's his main concern, is that he get the green card, that I don't see his children, which, you know, is very painful and is also crazy that I'm legally responsible for them, but I don't have any rights to see them.
Mm-hmm.
And then that the I-864 will continue to be enforced, but I owed him nothing for the last 2 years when we look at how much I actually did spend. And pay for him and the children. And so the next year I may actually owe something will be the year of 2021 and will true up in 2022. Now, again, he wanted this paid as alimony. I've gone back to how I've seen it enforced in other case law. You do a full year, you file your taxes, then they've got some skin in the game to be truthful, and then I have to make up the difference. So now, not getting a dime from me, he has more incentive to work.
Right.
And that's not always the case.
Well, and here's the thing. The beauty of it is he has the incentive to work. So if, assuming for a moment he does work, then his income would be used to offset what legal obligation, financial obligation you have under the 864. Let me give you an example.
Yes.
It's, what did we estimate this to be? What, about $24,000 a year?
28,000
because of the kids. All right, so you got $28,000. Let's assume he makes $30,000 before taxes. Then you owe him nothing.
Yep.
Because the $30,000 offsets the $28,000 you would normally pay him. So the only glitch to this is that you hope that he works on the books. If he works off the books, you got a problem. So, you know, we've got to see how that.
And I'm sure he will.
Well, we got to see how this develops. All right.
Well, there's that and the whole thing about it clocking towards the 10 years of Social Security earnings. So obviously under the table, but also contract work, because you're not paying into Social Security, doesn't count towards those quarters.
Right.
And Social Security earnings.
And that's the big misconception that a lot of people have with the 864. They're going, oh, 40 quarters, 10 years. No, it's got to be on the books for Social Security purposes. So if there's a break in the employment, let's say he works 5 years on the books, and then for whatever reason he comes off the books for whatever reason, then...
Or he runs his own company even.
Or runs his own company, and he becomes a Schedule C 1099 employee.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have some other issues to deal with. But I think what we're going to do, because we're coming up on an hour, is I want to save the resolution to all this with the 864 and VAWA until next week and the week after, because I'm going to invite you back on the show for the next 2 weeks at a minimum. So we can put our heads together and see what possible solutions are to this, because it's one thing to lay out all the problems, but if you don't come to the table with the solution, it's meaningless. So,
absolutely.
Will you come back next week?
I will be. I'll be there with bells on.
Okay. Well, Emily, I appreciate you coming on.
I'm just here because I want to tell my own story, because it gets it out of my own head, and I also want to help other people from becoming victim of this too.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm sure the listeners are going to appreciate it. So until next week, take care of yourself. We'll be in touch during the course of the week for pre-production. And we'll see you back on air in a week from today.
Sounds good.
Take care.
Thanks, John.
Take care. Bye. Please feel free to send me your comments on the Facebook page for Until Green Card Doers Part, or email me at csiinvestigations@neteason.net. That's netecin.net. Next week, we'll continue with Emily and what her suggestions are and what she and I have come up with on how to fix both the VAWA provisions of the immigration law and how to resolve the issue of the I-864 affidavit of support during the 2-year period of conditional permanent residence. You're not going to want to miss this. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm your host, John Sampson. See you next week.